Hello, I'm Liz, and I'm a member of this church, for any of you who don't know me. Last night, I went with my husband John, who's a really keen fly fisherman, to an event that he kind of arranges once a year, which is where, and I'm really sorry if you're vegetarian, I hope this won't offend you, but where all his friends who kill things gather together, cook them, and eat them. So there were things like French partridge, freshly shot about 3 weeks ago. There was rabbit, pheasant and pigeon casserole. There was Snowdonia caught fresh trout, terrine, all kinds of things. And, you know, when you know everyone, as each everything was served, the person who killed it gave the little story behind it, you know, where it was when they were shot, in a beautiful valley in the Cotswolds, whatever, shooting partridges. And when, you know, it's that clear before you where this thing you're eating has come from, you know, it makes you really aware that this thing sacrificed was sacrificed for me so that I could eat it. And so just that idea that this thing's death, as I put it into my body, is feeding me and giving me life, in a sense. So from death comes life. And then I cycled here with the children this morning, and I was reminded about this again as we put our bikes around the back of the church and locked them up. At the back of the church wall in the garden, there are some little plants, little, I don't know what they'll be, crocuses or daffodils, just growing up out of the crack right in the wall, right at the very base of the wall, just with the frost all around them, you know, pushing their way out of the wall, well, out of the ground near the wall, I suppose. But again, it just made me think, that shouldn't be happening. You know, this looks like a place of death today, in a sense. You know, there's frost, the ground's hard, looks like nothing should be alive. And yet there are these little plants, aren't there, at the moment, just pushing their way up out of the what looks like the dead earth to life. And that gives me hope. And those two illustrations are very much what we're going to be thinking about this morning as we look at some passages in Isaiah. Just that idea that from a place of death can come life, from a place of despair can come hope, and from a place of ruin can come restoration. And we've begun this series in Isaiah, and Stu touched on a few of these things last week when he introduced his sermon. The name Isaiah means Yahweh is salvation, which is a very apt meaning for his name, because we're going to be thinking today about God's salvation, the way that God brings salvation to the people that this book was addressed to, imminently from the dangers of attack and military attack, but also God's salvation ultimately for us from sin and death and evil. So salvation is a theme that runs through these chapters that we're going to be looking at. And that idea of restoration, that from utter ruin and despair, God can make something that's restored. Not just when the Bible speaks about God's restoration, it's not just talking about making something back the way it used to be. God's restoration restores something to something far more beautiful and perfect than it ever was in the first place. So those are the ideas that I want you to have in mind as we look at the passages today. So just going back to Isaiah, his name means Yahweh is salvation. But who was he? Well, he was a scholar and a prophet. So under the inspiration of God, he both spoke foretold and foretold. He spoke into the situation that was happening around him or that was going to happen. And he spoke about things that were yet to be, not just things that were yet to be within the century in which he lived, but things which are still yet to be. So his ministry, his prophecy spans from his own time right through to the time that hasn't yet been. He lived and worked in Jerusalem, and his prophetic message was mostly to the southern kingdom of Judah. So you may know or may not know that Israel as a country suffered civil war after King Solomon left the throne and was split into two kingdoms, the northern kingdom, which retained the name Israel, and the southern kingdom, which became known as Judah. But when I speak today about the people of Judah, I will refer to them as the Israelites, because in essentially that's who they were, the Israelite people, God's chosen people. And Isaiah began his ministry around 740 years before Jesus, and he prophesied for about 60 years. So I've already said he spoke to, and Stu said last week that he spoke to the southern kingdom of Judah. His prophecies were directed towards them. So what was life like in the southern kingdom of Judah around the time that Israel was prophesying? Well, very much in a way like our society today. There was worship of foreign gods. The Israelite people had allowed themselves to be defiled. Worship of foreign gods was tolerated and practiced by many of them. There was widespread family breakdown. Drunkenness was rife, corruption. The rich were oppressing the poor. And even the religious leaders, the priests, weren't giving religious spiritual leadership. Many of them were drunkards who accepted bribes. So really, it was in a pretty bad state. And the people of Israel had really completely lost their way and had forgotten who God was and who they were in him. So in about the year 597 BC, roughly around that time, the king of Babylon, which was a neighbouring kingdom to the east of Judah, they invaded and they took the city of Jerusalem and they took many people, mostly the most educated and skilled people from Jerusalem, and they forcibly marched them into exile in Babylon. So as they did that, these people were being marched with probably not a lot to take with them, maybe only what they could grab as they were forced out of the city. And they were marched away from Jerusalem. And I picture in my mind them looking back over their shoulders and realising that they were being dragged away from the promised land, the promised place that God had said would be theirs, where they would live in peace under his rule, and they were being walked away from that, so away from God's, the place that represented God's presence, the place that represented God's blessing, and they were being marched away from that. So they were marched to Babylon, and through the prophet Jeremiah, God told them that they were going to be there a while, so they ought to settle down and build houses. And the word of Jeremiah says in the Bible, it says, settle down, build houses, plant gardens, and grow in number. So on the one hand, I guess, life in Babylon sort of carried on as normal on one level for the Israelites. But on the other hand, they were living under the oppression of a foreign king. They lived at his whim, and his whim often made life really difficult for them. He could just pass the law just like that to make their expression of their faith really difficult. They were also subject to false teachers and prophets from among their own people, feeding them all kinds of rubbish, supposedly in the name of God. So there they were, living in Babylon, in a place of disgrace, really. And how must they have felt? Well, I think they must have felt disgraced. Perhaps they were aware, some of them at least, that this was God's judgment on them. God had taken them to the promised land and had said to them, you can stay there as long as you live my way, and then you will enjoy my blessing. But they had realized, perhaps, that they had been taken in disgrace out of that place because of their disobedience and were now living in relative degradation in Babylon. They must have felt displaced. A sense of displacement. They were in unfamiliar territory. They were in a place where there was a different language. They must have felt isolated. They must also have felt despairing, I imagine, after a time. Despairing. Have we gone too far this time? Can God forgive us? Or have we just gone too far? We've been dumped in this land of Babylon, totally foreign to us, under the oppression of a foreign king. Will we ever be allowed to go back to where we truly should be? If you've ever felt despairing, or perhaps disgraced or displaced, then I think these chapters that we're going to read in a moment will have something to say to you. So let's get started. We haven't had the passage read all the way through. It's quite a long passage, but today I wanted to do something a bit different, which is to read the passage in sections and then try to draw out some of what each section says as we go along. So let's start. Let's look at Isaiah chapter 51, and it's on page 738 of the Bibles, which are hopefully in the back of the chairs. So Isaiah chapter 51, page 738 in the Bible. So we'll read this in chunks and then go back over some of the main points. So just verses 1 to 8. Listen to me, you who pursue righteousness, and you who seek the Lord. Look to the rock from which you were cut, and to the quarry from which you were hewn. Look to Abraham, your father, and to Sarah, who gave you birth. When I called him, he was but one, and I blessed him and made him many. The Lord will surely comfort Zion and will look with compassion on all her ruins. He will make her deserts like Eden, her wastelands like the garden of the Lord. Joy and gladness will be found in her, thanksgiving and the sound of singing. Listen to me, my people. Hear me, my nation. The law will go out from me. My justice will become a light to the nations. My righteousness draws near speedily. My salvation is on the way, and my arm will bring justice to the nations. The islands will look to me and wait in hope for my arm. Lift up your eyes to the heavens. Look at the earth beneath. The heavens will vanish like smoke. The earth will wear out like a garment, and its inhabitants die like flies. But my salvation will last forever. My righteousness will never fail. Hear me, you who know what is right, you people who have my law in your hearts. Do not fear the reproach of men or be terrified by their insults, for the moth will eat them up like a garment, the worm will devour them like wool, but my righteousness will last forever, my salvation through all generations. So here we have the Lord speaking. It is God who is speaking. Through Isaiah. And who is he addressing? Well, he's addressing those who pursue righteousness. And in verse 7, you who know what is right. So he's addressing the righteous remnant, what was known as the righteous remnant of Israel in Babylon. So those who were still seeking after God, wanting to know, what is the purpose of us being here? Why are we here, Lord? Will you do something? So he's addressing those people. And what does he say to them? Well, he says, listen, did you notice how he said that three times in verses 1, 4, and then in 7, hear me. He's saying, listen to me. These people must have forgotten about listening to God. They were just getting head down, getting on with their lives, just probably trying to survive, many of them. That's how we go around sometimes, isn't it? Head down, just get on with it. God says, listen to me. Turn your ear to me. And what does he tell them to do? He tells them to remember. That's what he's saying when he says, look to Abraham. Remember Abraham? He's your father, the father of your nation. And Sarah, he was just one man. And what did I do? I made him many. I made him into a nation beyond number, the countless number of people. This is what I have done. Remember what I have done. And as we remember what God has done, and as the Israelites looked back and remembered what God had done in their nation, could give them hope and faith about what God would do in the future. God says, I will make Zion's desert like Eden. So a place of total aridity, total dryness and infertility will be like Eden. Eden, as you probably know, is the garden that God created in the beginning of time for Adam and Eve to live in. So it represents not just a beautiful garden with lush planting and lovely, you know, shrubs and what have you. It represents God's perfection in the beginning, as things were meant to be, as God intended the world to be. He's saying, I will make your desert, your place of desert, like the Garden of Eden. In other words, perfect. I will take your wastelands and make them like gardens. Wasteland is a place where there is chaos. There's no order. There's no planting. But God will take their wastelands and make it a place of order, a place of planting, a place of fertility and growth once again. Can you imagine the effect that these words had on those reading them in exile? Joy and gladness will be found in you, thanksgiving and the sound of singing. They were in a place of despair, place of isolation, and God's saying to them, joy, you will feel joy and gladness. You will sing. Have you noticed how when life is so wearying and tragic, or when you're in a place of despondency, how you lose the desire and the ability to sing? You know, that heaviness of heart that you get when you have bad news or when things are particularly hard. You don't want to sing. You lose the desire to sing. But God says there will be the sound of singing. Where there has not been the sound of singing, where there has been grieving and wailing, there will be the sound of singing. Just want to look at verses 4 and 5 briefly again. Notice how many times God says me or my, the personal pronoun. Listen to me, my people. Hear me, my nation. The law will go out from me. My justice will become a light to the nations. My righteousness draws near. My salvation's on the way. My arm will bring justice. Islands will look to me and hope for my arm. What is God saying here? I think he's saying, it's not about you. It's not about you. It's about me. It's about my character, my authority. It's about who I am. My love for you, my desire to rescue you. Lift up your heads and look to me. I'm the only one who can rescue you. Okay. Let's move on a little bit. Let's go into the next part of the passage, verses 9 to, we'll go up to 11. So we've heard God's word to the Israelites through Isaiah. Now hear this. Awake, awake, clothe yourself with strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake as in days gone by, as in generations of old. Was it not you who cut Rahab to pieces, who pierced that monster through? Was it not you who dried up the sea, the waters of the deep, who made a road in the depths of the sea so that the redeemed might cross over? The ransomed of the Lord will return. They will enter Zion with singing. Everlasting joy will crown their heads. Gladness and joy will overtake them, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. Now, who's speaking here? Well, it's obviously not God, because this address is God. Wake, O arm of the Lord. This is Isaiah responding. A heartfelt response to what he has heard God say through him. So he's spoken prophetically God's words. And now you'll see the end of speech marks at the end of verse 8. So that's the end of God speaking. Now Isaiah is responding. He's saying, yes, Lord, I like it. I like what I've heard. I like what you're saying. Do it. Please, Lord, wake, awake. Do what you said you will do. And I find this inspirational. Isaiah must have been an amazing guy. You know, how often do we read God's promises, read God's plans, or hear God speaking to us directly through his spirit and hear his promises and then just forget them and fail to do what Isaiah is doing, which is to respond proactively, yes, Lord, I'm going to pray in your promises. Please do what you've said you will do. Isaiah must have been a man who dreamt dreams, you know, who allowed God to fire his imagination, who allowed God's word and God's promises to fire him up and make him passionate and excited. And that's a real lesson for us, I think. Who's Rahab? It says, was it not you who cut Rahab to pieces? Well, Rahab was Isaiah's pet name for Egypt. And he's saying, it was you, Lord. It was you, wasn't it? God's told him to remember in the passage just before, told us all to remember. Now he's saying, I remember. It was you who cut up Rahab. It was you who destroyed Egypt. And didn't he just? God brought Egypt to a point of desolation at that time when the Israelites had been in slavery there for generations. What did God do when he sent the 10 plagues to Egypt? He utterly devastated that land. He brought to inactivity, I suppose, their great river, the River Nile, when he sent the plague there. He devastated the land, he devastated the crops, he devastated the livestock, he took the health of the people by sending a plague of boils. He must have destroyed their mental strength after a while, because in the end they were crying out to the Israelites to leave. He destroyed their army when they pursued the Israelites. He had them slaughtered at the Red Sea, and he took the firstborn sons, so he put every family into bereavement. Now that all sounds pretty horrific, doesn't it? This is the power of the God we worship. And Isaiah is saying, I remember you, Lord. This was what you achieved on behalf of your people in the days of the Exodus. What a powerful memory that is to have. Okay, moving on. Let's read verses 12 to 16. I, even I, am he who comforts you. Who are you that you fear mortal men? The sons of men who are but grass, that you forget the Lord your Maker, who stretched out the heavens and laid the foundations of the earth, that you live in constant terror every day because of the wrath of the oppressor who is bent on destruction. For where is the wrath of the oppressor? The cowering prisoners will soon be set free. They will not die in their dungeon, nor will they lack bread. For I am the Lord your God, who churns up the sea so that its waves roar. The Lord Almighty is his name. I have put my words in your mouth and covered you with the shadow of my hand. I, who set the heavens in place, who laid the foundations of the earth, and who say to Zion, you are my people. God is reminding them there of who they are. They had forgotten who they were. They were a scattered people. They were a displaced people. They were a people in utter despair. And God says to them as their loving Father, you are my people. Don't forget that. Verses 17 to 23. Awake, awake, rise up, O Jerusalem, you who have drunk from the hand of the Lord the cup of his wrath, you who have drained it to its dregs, the goblet that makes men stagger. Of all the sons she bore, there was none to guide her. Of all the sons she brought up, there was none to take her by the hand. These double calamities have come upon you. Who can comfort you? Ruin and destruction, famine and sword. Who can console you? Your sons have fainted. They lie at the head of every street, like antelope caught in a net. They are filled with the wrath of the Lord and the rebuke of your God. Therefore, hear this, you afflicted one, made drunk, but not with wine. This is what your sovereign Lord says, your God who defends his people. See, I have taken out of your hand the cup that made you stagger. From that cup, the goblet of my wrath, you will never drink again. I will put it into the hands of your tormentors, who said to you, fall prostrate that we may walk over you. And you made your back like the ground, like a street to be walked on. So, we've heard God say, listen to me. We've heard Isaiah say, wake up, Lord, do what you've said. And now Isaiah says, wake up, O Jerusalem. Wake up, Israelites. Wake up, people of God. You've been drunk on the cup of God's wrath. So there's this recognition there that the reason the Israelites have been suffering in exile was because of God's anger. God had warned the Israelites over and over and over again, you must live by my laws, otherwise you will not stay in this promised land which I have given you. Through many prophets he warned them. And so there's a recognition here that they are now living the consequences of not having done that. They're drunk the cup of God's wrath. But what does God say in this second part of that passage in verse 22? He says, I have now taken that cup out of your hands, and you will never drink from it again. In other words, this is a prophecy about the fact that God is going to remove his wrath from mankind forever in some eternal way, which is what he did when he sent his own son to die on our behalf. I will achieve for you a salvation, and you will never have to suffer my wrath again. Implicit in this idea that God put the cup of wrath into Israel's hand and can take it away, in this sense that God has taken away the cup, is the sense that he gave the cup to them in the first place. Now he's going to pass the cup to Israel's enemies. He's going to pass the cup to the Babylonians and to many other countries which had oppressed and attacked Israel. God is the God of nations. He can use nations to accomplish his will and his kingdom, and this is what he has done here. Let's go on to chapter 52. Let's read verses 1 to 10 to begin with. Awake, awake, O Zion, clothe yourself with strength, put on your garments of splendor. O Jerusalem, the holy city, the uncircumcised and defiled will not enter you again. Shake off your dust, rise up, sit enthroned, O Jerusalem. Free yourself from the chains on your neck, O captive daughter of Zion. For this is what the Lord says. You were sold for nothing, and without money you will be redeemed. For this is what the sovereign Lord says. At first my people went down to Egypt to live. Lately Assyria has oppressed them. And now what do I have here, declares the Lord? For my people have been taken away for nothing, and those who rule them mock, declares the Lord. All day long my name is constantly blasphemed. Therefore my people will know my name. Therefore in that day they will know that it is I who foretold it. Yes, it is I. How beautiful on the mountains are the feet of those who bring good news, who proclaim peace, who bring good tidings, who proclaim salvation, who say to Zion, your God reigns. Listen, your watchmen lift up their voices. Together they shout for joy. When the Lord returns to Zion, they will see it with their own eyes. Burst into songs of joy together, you ruins of Jerusalem, for the Lord has comforted his people. He has redeemed Jerusalem. The Lord will lay bare his holy arm in the sight of all the nations, and all the ends of the earth will see the salvation of our God. So for the third time we hear these words, awake, awake, in verse 1. Isaiah has spoken to God to awake. Isaiah has spoken to the people of Jerusalem prophetically to awake. And now Isaiah speaks, awake, awake, O Zion. You have been in despair. You needed to listen to the voice of God. You needed to remember what God has done. You need to remember who you are. And then you needed to wake up from your drunken slumber. And now you need to get dressed. What do we do when we wake up? We generally get dressed. So this all is beginning to make sense. Get dressed. And what must they get dressed in? They must get dressed with strength. They must put on garments of splendor. It's as if, you know, some homeless vagrant has gone to sleep on a park bench after a night of serious drinking and has woken up in the morning to beautiful sunshine and to find, lying next to the park bench, that someone has laid out for him the most beautiful royal-looking clothes. You know, a cloak and a crown and a staff, maybe, with beautiful, beautiful clothes, all laid out for him to put on. And on top of the clothes is a little note that says, you are not a nobody. going nowhere, with nothing to your name. You are a somebody. There has been mistaken identity. You are a member of the royal household. You are a member of the king's family. Put on these clothes. These are the clothes you should be wearing, not the shabby stuff you're dressed in, not the dirty, scraggy clothes, but these royal clothes. You're actually a member of the royal family. And it's like that for Israel. They had begun to mistake their own identity. They had forgotten who they were. And now God is saying, get up and get dressed in the proper clothes. You should be wearing clothes of royalty, clothes of splendor, because you are that precious and important to me. And then this royal theme is continued in verse 2. Shake off your dust, sit up, rise up, sit enthroned. Get up off the park bench and go and sit on the king's throne. It's such a contrast, isn't it, for them to get their heads round who they really were in God, their identity in God. So they've woken up and they've got dressed in their right clothes. I just want to look at verse 3 for a moment, because this is such a poignant verse. You were sold for nothing, and without money you will be redeemed. They were sold for nothing. They were dragged out of their own homes in disgrace and shame. But they will be redeemed without money. In Alec Mateer's commentary on Isaiah, he says this: redemption is essentially a price-paying concept. Without money here means without cost to you, or by some payment other than money. Someone else will pay, and the price will not be silver. In 1 Peter chapter 1, we read these words: for you know that it was not with perishable things, such as silver or gold, that you were redeemed, but with the precious blood of Christ, a lamb without blemish or defect. He was chosen before the creation of the world, but was revealed in these last times for your sake. So this verse speaks prophetically to us now, not just to the people of Israel then, that it's without money we have been redeemed, without cost to ourselves. Let's go down to verse 6. God is... do you sense his despair here almost, his distress at the fact that his name is being constantly blasphemed in this place where they are living? And he says, therefore my people will know my name. Knowing the name of God in the Old Testament had more significance than just learning a name, like a teacher might need to learn the names of a new class. It's not just about learning God's name. Knowing God's name was about knowing God's presence. In Deuteronomy 12, we read this: but you are to seek the place the Lord your God will choose from among all your tribes, to put his name there for his dwelling. To that place you must go, and there in the presence of the Lord your God, you will eat and rejoice in everything you've put your hand to, because the Lord your God has blessed you. So knowing God's name was about knowing God's presence. His name represented his presence. But it was also about knowing his character. In Exodus chapter 34, we read this: then the Lord came down in the cloud and stood there with Moses and proclaimed his name, the Lord. And he passed in front of Moses, proclaiming, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands and forgiving wickedness, rebellion and sin. So knowing God's name, God's desire was that his people and all nations should once and for all know his name, know who he was, his character, and know his presence. Okay, verses 7 and 8, just very briefly. I think we need to get our heads around the fact that some of these Israelites living in Babylon in exile had never known any different. They'd been born into exile in Babylon, many of them. So they had been living under the authority of a foreign king almost all their lives. In fact, all their lives for many of them. So So if you ask them, well, who reigns over you? Who rules over you? I reckon their answer would have been, well, the king of Babylon. You know, we're subject to him. We have to do everything he says. But this verse 7, comes in. It's a subversive message. It says to Zion, your God reigns, not the king of Babylon. Your God reigns. No Babylonian God, no Assyrian God, no Egyptian God, just your God. He reigns, he's in control. Your destiny is in his hands, not the human king's hands. He's your God and he's coming to rescue you. Finally, the last two verses of this chapter, verse 11 and 12, say this. Depart, depart, go out from there, touch no unclean thing, come out from it and be pure, you who carry the vessels of the Lord. But you will not leave in haste or go in flight, for the Lord will go before you, the God of Israel will be your rear guard. So, they have listened to God's word, they have remembered who God is and who they are, they have woken up from their drunken state, and they have got dressed in their rightful clothes. And now they have to go. Depart, depart. Go, leave. Go out from there. What does this mean? You who carry the vessels of the Lord. Who was that referring to? Well, in Old Testament times, you remember that it was the tribe of the Levites who were chosen to be a special holy priesthood, who looked after all the things in relation to the tabernacle that the Israelites carried through the desert and the temple once they arrived in the promised land. So the Levites were charged with that honoured task of looking after the vessels of the Lord, all the containers, all the paraphernalia that went with the tabernacle, with the temple. So that's who this is referring to. But who is that royal priesthood now? One of Jesus' disciples wrote a letter to the early Christian church in what is now known as Turkey. And this letter was written to non-Jewish Christians, so Gentile Christians. And he said this, "But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness and into his wonderful light." That's to us. Most of us here, in fact, maybe all of us, are Gentile Christians, but it speaks to Jewish Christians, obviously, as well. We are now this priesthood, part of this priesthood. This priesthood must leave Babylon. We must leave darkness and walk into the light. God has rescued us from the only thing that can stand in the way of our pure relationship with him, sin. He's provided us with the kingly robes of righteousness. And we must put them on and go out into the world, knowing who we are in him and knowing who he is. So these people who carry the vessels of the Lord, this addresses us as well as God's holy priesthood now, cleansed by the blood of Jesus. And finally, verse 12, you will not leave in haste or go in flight. Why does he say that? Why might they be thinking that they might have to leave in haste or go in flight? Well, I think this takes us back again to the first Exodus. Do you remember in the story of the Exodus how the Israelites, the night before they were set free from captivity in Egypt, God told them to eat a Passover meal, but to eat it with their cloak tucked into their belt. In other words, that was a stance of readiness, that they were ready to go quickly in the morning. And they needed to go quickly in the morning, because do you remember how Pharaoh said, "You can go, I've had enough of your God's plagues, you can go, I set you free." But do you remember how when they had left, he changed his mind and he sent his army after them to slaughter them. So they had to leave in haste, they had to be ready and go in haste. But God says here, you will not leave in haste or go in flight, for the Lord your God will go before you, the God of Israel will be your rear guide. This time you will leave in a dignified procession with the Lord before you and behind you. They don't need to hurry because God has done everything necessary to secure their safety.
There is no enemy that can pursue them. The enemy has been completely defeated. And this is where we find ourselves today, unbelievably. There is no enemy that can stand against God. God is on our side. God goes before us. God goes behind us. We do not need to live in fear. We can process as God's people in dignity and without hurrying. So let's just look briefly at 5 points that we can perhaps remember and apply to our lives today. Firstly, listen. Time and again in chapter 51, God says to his people, listen. Do we give time to listen to God? Do we really give him time to speak to us? Or are we too busy rushing about? We can listen to God in many ways. Just through reading his word, we are listening to his word to us. But through stillness and solitude, we can also hear God's voice speaking to us. Secondly, in chapter 51, God told the Israelites to remember. And we would do well to remember what God has done in our lives, to feed our faith on his acts. Have you ever had a time as a Christian when you felt despairing of God? You wondered where God has gone, how God could possibly be interested in what was going on, because otherwise surely he'd do something about it. Sometimes when I've been in that situation, the only thing, if I'm honest, that has kept me a Christian is remembering what God has done in my life in the past, because there are pretty much undeniable, as far as I'm concerned, things which have happened in my life over years which make the existence of God very difficult for me to deny. And so we would do well to remember God's goodness to us and the things he has done in the past, but also to remember who we are in him. We are precious, chosen, called, and redeemed. Thirdly, we need to look to God's future plan. We need to be inspired by people like Isaiah, who dreamt dreams, who dared to hope for the invisible, who prayed in the impossible. You know, this must have seemed impossible to the Israelites at the time they read these words in exile. Impossible that such singing and rejoicing and rescue could happen. We need to pray for what we think is humanly impossible. We, by looking ahead, looking and understanding God's plan for his world and for us, we can bring God's tomorrow into our today by living in our understanding of what he wants to achieve today. We can bring his kingdom in today. Fourthly, clothe yourself with righteousness. Take full account of what Jesus achieved on the cross and live in it. You don't need to live in condemnation. You don't need to live under guilt. Jesus achieved everything necessary for you to be clothed in beautiful garments of righteousness. And finally, go. As the passage said, depart, depart, go. God is before us and God is behind us. God doesn't promise, does he, to make everything okay. He doesn't promise that life will be easy. He doesn't promise that problems will be taken away. But he does promise his presence with us. He does promise to be with us in the rubbish, in the bad times. He is with us, even when we can't feel him. And we need to take these words to heart, that we will never drink from the cup of his wrath again. We will never be separated from God again if we believe in Jesus' salvation for us. And live in it, we will never be abandoned. Let's pray.